comment could be made on dozens of the brilliant thoughts and concepts presented in Imperium, such as, for one example, his relegating economics to its proper level, organically the alimentary tract, that is, the food tract, his advocacy of European unification long before the idea had gained any headway, is another case in point. This is perhaps a proof of his assertion that things are considered extreme today are the dogmas tomorrow. The genius lives in the future, as he says, and whereas he used to be considered merely a little odd by his contemporaries and avoided or tolerantly humored, unless, that is, he incurred the righteous wrath of the Church, in which case things could be made very hot for him, he is today declared by modern Freudianism to be mentally ill and unfit for the ancient protections of law. And this is surely indicative of the, quote, progress we have made in 1,000 years. The significance of the pseudonym Yaki chose as a author of Imperium, Ulrich Verein, should be noted. Ulrich is a given Irish name derived from Danish and meaning reward of the mind. Verein, of course, refers to the Vereingians, that far-roving band of Norse heroes led by Rurik, who upon R-U-R-I-K, who upon invitation from the Slavs came to civilize Russia in the 9th century, built the Russian imperial state and formed the gifted and handsome Russian aristocracy until they were butchered by the Bolsheviks, along with some 20 million other Christians and Muslims, in that bloody terror. The name, therefore, drawn as it is from the Eastern and Western antipodes of Europe, signifies a Europe united, quote, from the rocky promontories of Galway to the Urals, all of Europe, as he himself exhorts. Finally, the surname Verein by itself signifies the Western origin of historic Russia. Imperium throughout is, again as the author says, not a book in the sense that it presents an argument. It is prophetic, the work of an intuitive seer. You will find no bibliography or footnotes in Imperium for this reason, in spite of the vast reading that the author has obviously done. And it is prophetic not only in the large historical sense, for could Yaki have been thinking of himself and predicting his own violent end when he stresses that the prophets of a new age often come to unnatural deaths? Twice this thought is brought out, once in the chapter The Articulation of a Culture, and again, Genius, both those sets capitalized, The Articulation of a Culture and Genius. Another interesting and mysterious fact about the manuscript he completed at Britis Bay, and that you now hold in your hand, is that it is keyed, so that if the secret code can be discovered, the author's name is spelled. Thus, the question of authenticity, which is always raised about a great work after the author dies, cannot ever be a problem with Imperium. Another break for asterisks, or markated by asterisks. It is important to seek the origins of Yaki's philosophy, for all are compelled to build on the backs of those who have gone before, and to see the past clearly is to understand more fully. With more exaggeration than accuracy, Yaki states, there is nothing original in the content of this book. A grounding in Oswald Spengler is fundamental to understanding Yaki. In fact, it can be said that Imperium is really a sequel to Spengler's monumental The Decline of the West. Spengler, of course, is persona non grata to prevailing intellects for reasons that become very clear to any reader of Decline, so this revival of his influence, an inevitable revival, I'll add, will be a great shock to the tender minds of the beatniks, liberals, and communists who have sucked at the dry pap of historical conformity for so long. These intellectual infants are always very eager to assure us that Spengler is, quote, repudiated, unquote, a favorite semantic weapon of theirs, used regularly whenever they wish to avoid discussing issues and facts. But Oswald Spengler, the philosopher of the 20th century, as Yaki calls him, along with Gregor Mendel, Thomas Malthus, and Charles Darwin, has shown us the pattern of the world of yesterday and the outline of it in the future, for better or for worse. Each of these giants is primarily in his own field of study, and to study history while rejecting Spengler is quite as foolish as studying disease and rejecting the germ theory, or studying mathematics and rejecting numbers. The pathetic intellectual nihilists, materialists, equalists, and do-gooders may yap at the heels of Spengler until they are hoarse, but history cannot hear them. In this book is attempted, for the first time, the venture of predetermining history, Spengler opens Decline, and it follows with two thick volumes of delightful and profound excursions into world history, war, philosophy, poetry, music, art, politics, religion, even mathematics. Perhaps the best synopsis of Spengler, if there can be such a thing, has been done by Egon Friedell, Friedell, in his A Cultural History of the Modern Age, a three-volume work of which, incidentally, Yaki was very fond. Says Friedell in listing significant thinkers, "Lastly," and this is a block quote, "and with deep admiration," Friedell on Spengler, "we come to the name of Oswald Spengler, perhaps the most powerful and vivid thinker to appear on German soil since Nietzsche. One has to climb very high in the world's literature to find works of such scintillating and exuberant intellect, such triumphant psychological vision, and such a personal and suggestive rhythmic cadence as his Decline of the West. What Spengler gives us in his two volumes is the, quote, outlines of a morphology of world history. He sees, in place of the, quote, monotonous picture of linear world history, the, quote, phenomenon of a plurality of mighty cultures. Each culture has its own new possibilities of self-expression, which arise, ripen, decay, and never return. There is not one sculpture, one painting, one mathematic, one physics, but many, each in its deepest essence different from the others, each limited in duration and self-contained, just as each species of plant has its peculiar blossom or fruit and its special type of growth and decline. These cultures, sublimated life essences, grow with the same superb aimlessness as the flowers of the field. Cultures are organisms, and cultural history is their biography." Spengler establishes nine such cultures: the Babylonian, the Egyptian, the Indian, the Chinese, the Classical, the Arabian, the Mexican, the Western, and the Russian. And he throws light upon each in turn, naturally not an equally bright and full light in every case, as of course our information concerning them is very unequal. But in the evolutionary course of these cultures, certain parallelisms rule, and this leads Spengler to introduce the conception of, quote, contemporary, unquote, phenomena, by which he understands historical facts that, quote, each in its own culture occur in the same relative positions, and therefore have an exactly corresponding significance. Contemporary, for example, are the rise of the Ionic and that of the Baroque, Polygnatus and Rembrandt, Polycletus and Bach, Socrates and Voltaire are contemporaries. But within the individual culture itself, too, there is a naturally complete congruence of all its life expressions at each of its stages of evolution. So, for instance, there is a deep connection of form between the classical polis and the Euclidean geometry, between the space perspective of the Western oil painting and the conquest of space by railways, telephones, and long-range weapons. By means of these and like guiding principles, now Spengler arrives at the most interesting and surprising discoveries. The Protestant Brown of the Dutch and the atheistic plein air of the Manet school, the way as prime symbol of the Egyptian soul and the plain as the leitmotif of the Russian world outlook, the Magian culture of the Arabs, and the Faustian culture of the West, the second religiousness in which late culture revives the images of their youth, and the Faladum, in which man becomes again historyless, these and many more like them are unforgettable glimpses of genius that light up for a moment vast tracts of night, incomparable discoveries and hints of an intellect that possesses a truly creative eye for analogies. That the Sumerians of learning have opposed to such a work nothing but stolidity and a deaf incomprehension of what his questions and answers are about, is not surprising to anyone who knows the customs and mentality of the Republic of Scholarship. And that's a long black quote from Friedel on Spengler. Spengler published Decline in July 1918, and we are still being washed in the very first breakwaters of that titanic event. For the decline of the West was fully as revolutionary to the study of history in 1918 as Copernicus's theory of heliocentricity was to the study of astronomy in 1543. What we may ask is the main cause of resistance to accepting Spengler, aside from the fact that he is a massive roadblock to the total victory of the Marxist liberal intellectual? The main difficulties, I think, are two: the necessity of acknowledging the essentially alien nature of every cultural soul, and the apparent necessity to reconcile ourselves to the dismal fact that our own Western organism must, too, die, as have all those which have passed before. Paradoxically, the fundamental problem of the second difficulty lies in the very Faustian soul of the West, which Spengler himself defined. Quote, "The Faustian soul, whose prime symbol is pure and limitless space," he said, and it is true, for we need in our innermost being the perpetual reach to infinity. The idea of unlimited progress flows from this spiritual reality. This is a concept which is deeply and inextricably embedded in every man of the West. Thus the thought of inevitable death draws a fundamental rejection and is called pessimism. As for the first specific difficulty, the acknowledgement of the essentially alien nature of each cultural soul, it follows that if every culture has its own inner vitality, it will be uninfluenced by the spirit of any other. This also runs against the very deepest grain of Western man who, for 500 years and more, has been proselyting men all over the world in the vain hope of making them over into his own beloved image. This psychological block runs deep in the West, so deep that it is an error which is apparent in all philosophical strata, certainly not only the leftist variety. Name any philosopher, economist, or religious adept of Western history except Hegel, yes, even including Spengler, and you are virtually certain to find a man who sought to lay universal laws of human behavior. Who, in other words, saw no essential difference between races. This error is so fundamental it is usually unconscious. What would Lord Keynes, for example, do with his universal theory of over-saving if he were trying to apply it to Ghana or Haiti? The Roman Catholic Church is a case in point. Tradition-minded Westerners rightly speak of the Church as being a bulwark of the West, but sometimes go so far as to identify the Church as the West. Unfortunately, the compliment is not returned. The Holy Roman Church is a universal church, one church for all men, which sees all people, wherever they are and whoever they are, as equal human souls whose bodies are to be brought to the holy embrace of Vatican City. It is the first to reject the impious suggestion that it owes a primary loyalty to the West. Scientific and philosophical demonstrations that men and cultures are, nevertheless, different in many fundamental respects, and that it is unhealthy, unethical to mix them are sure to meet with the same inhospitable reaction or reception that the Church earlier gave to Copernicus and Galileo. In April of 1962, three Catholics in New Orleans were excommunicated for daring to stand on this heretical verity. And then there's an asterisk, which we'll get to, but first, skipped over an earlier asterisk. He says even Spengler is a universalist. So for the last 500 years, Western man has been addicted to universalism. And the asterisk reads, extracts from the long, interesting introduction to Georg Wilhelm Friedrich Hegel's Philosophy of History. Block quote. The peculiarly African character is difficult to comprehend, for the very reason that in reference to it, we must give up the principle which accompanies all our ideas, the category of universality. Another characteristic fact in reference to the Negro is slavery. Bad as this may be, their lot in their own land is even worse, since a slavery there quite as absolute exists, for it is the essential principle of slavery that man has not yet attained to the consciousness of his own freedom, and consequently sinks down to a mere thing, an object of no value. Among the Negro, moral sentiments are quite weak, or more strictly speaking, non-existent. Parents sell their children, and conversely, children their parents, as either has the opportunity. The polygamy of the Negroes has frequently for its object the having of many children, to be sold, every one of them, into slavery. From these various traits, it is manifest that want of self-control distinguishes the character of the Negroes. This condition is capable of no development or culture, and we see them at this day such as they have always been. At this point we leave Africa, not to mention it again, for it is no historical part of the world, it has no movement or development to exhibit. And that is a footnote on Hegel and his acknowledgement that there is no universal humanity. And Africa doesn't even have a history because they haven't yet attained the level of self-consciousness. They're just objects. And now, moving ahead to the footnote on the next page about the three excommunicated for apparently resisting the universalism of the church. Because they say the church is the West, but Cardo makes the point that the church is universalist. All men need the church, claims the church. It's like Islam. And the footnote here at the asterisk says, in his final work, History of the People of Israel, Ernest Renan said, socialism may bring back the complicity of Catholicism as a new Middle Age. And there are indeed some rather horrifying straws in the wind as regards the Church's traditional hostility toward communism. March 7, 1963, witnessed the Pope grasping the hand of Alexei Adzubi, an official representative of the same Bolshevism which has so far murdered at least 50 million patriots in Russia, China, and elsewhere. What are millions to think, Catholic and non-Catholic, who have heretofore looked upon Rome as a bulwark against this unspeakable degenerate conspiracy? Decent Catholics should not be too surprised or chagrined. Protestant sects, by and large, were captured by the culture distorter years ago. And culture distorter is their word for Marxists, Bolsheviks, liberals, or SJWs, as we might call them, in 2016. And again, this is right before Vatican II when he's writing this, I think. And that was 64. And so he's talking about stuff in 63, but right around the same time. But should the two equalitarian religions converge, compromise is required on the part of the Communist Party, too. Being totally bankrupt intellectually, this is not too great a price. An anonymous letter supposedly written by a CP member, Communist Party member, was reprinted in the May 1963 Truth Seeker, a strongly anti-communist free thought periodical. It bears repetition. Again, we're still in the footnote. The party has soft-pedaled atheism for years, and now we are dropping it completely. Atheism divides the masses and offends all the good religious people in the party who work closely with us. Fanatical atheists who insist on preaching their views are thrown out. Confusing the political problems we have with religious matters is asinine. By far the most progress the party is making today is being made through the churches. I expect to see a complete convergence of the Catholic Church and the party within the next 50 years. The shadow of this is clearly foreshown in Poland. Perhaps you have heard of PAX. This is a Catholic lay organization run by communist priests, tolerated by both the party and the church. You may yet live to see the day when the dictatorship of the proletariat will be proclaimed by the Pope. So that's kind of an interesting view on the ability of these Jewish universalism that is communism and Jewish for Goyim universalism that is Christianity to work together. I would just say, from being in D.C., liberal Catholics are some of the oddest humanic creatures I have personally ever come across. They're disturbingly very different from the way that I look at the world. Now, back to the main text here. A central point when thinking about this subject is the growth and now the total supremacy of the Western idea of technics. The entire world of science is a reflection of Western man and no other, and we have seen Western technics conquer the world. We see our science being appropriated to varying degrees in varying manners by every simian culture on the planet, which has advanced beyond the arboreal stage, beyond the trees. Arbor Day. The Stone Age Negro denizens of Africa, Haiti, New Guinea, and the southern Philippines are fascinated by clocks, radios, and even sails. When an American city wants to get rid of its old streetcars, it sells them to Amerindian Mexico. The Semitic Arabs ride their Cadillacs and use rifles made in Belgium, both of which are bought with the gold of oil royalties from Wall Street, Dallas, or London. The Oriental Chinese have learned well and are expected to explode an atomic bomb at any moment. And even the half-Western Russians from the days of Peter the Great, or even Rurik, have constructed their ships, cannon, and rockets with European engineers. But does this mass appropriation of Western techniques have the slightest effect on the inner and distinctive soul of the culture which appropriates? Isn't that funny seeing Willis Cardo use cultural appropriation about 60, 70 years before it was commonly used by the left? But he says the answer is no. So they come to us for our engineering, but they don't understand it or have our soul at all. And we should not allow our foolish pride to think otherwise. We think, oh, they're adopting our technology. They're becoming like us, but they're not. They're just using what we have because it's better. The other cause of rejecting Spengler lies in the difficulty of reconciling ourselves to the apparent necessity of the death of the West as a cultural organism. But it is not necessary, in my opinion, to make the reconciliation, for although a culture is an organism, it is a peculiar one. By accepting the analogy in the first place, we are able to intelligently seek for the possibility of extending or renewing its life. Yaki rejects this hypothesis and, as a thorough Spenglerian, foresees the end of the West. But it can be argued that the very introduction of the organic concept into historical philosophizing and theorizing, plus the unparalleled mastery over nature which the West has attained, and the infinite possibilities of this for the future, hold out the conception that the organism of the West need not suffer the same destiny as cultures which have gone before and which had none of this knowledge. In other words, we now have the proper concept, thanks to Spengler, and have, for the first time in all history, identified the pathology of culture, thanks to Yaki. And in addition, Western techniques have created the equally unique physical means to apply to the problem. To carry this examination further, the Western culture excels all others in history in these areas. 1. The obsession with fact history. 2. The development of the organic concept of culture and recognition of its pathology. 3. The development of science and master techniques, nearing subjection of the microcosm in time and the macrocosm in space. Let us now turn to the so far final and, according to Spengler, the inevitable phase of a culture, the imperialistic. First of all, it is in this area that the Spenglerian theory, as applied to the venue of predetermining history, appears to falter because the West appears to be behind on the timetable. Yaki comments on this and attributes it to the retarding influence of money. This is probably true. The question is, if money can disturb the cycle, cannot other things too? Here may be mentioned another unique fact as regards the Western situation. The condition of overproduction has become a fact of life that almost all sectors of political opinion are loath to recognize. Nevertheless, this is a fundamental departure for men with widespread implications. Until now, slavery was necessary to support a high standard of living. And of course, slavery has always been sanctioned by religion and law when it is economically desirable. So were foreign conquests for exploitation. This is no longer the case, he says in italics. The main economic problem for the West is to dispose of its surplus production, not to feed and clothe its masses. This elemental truth is known by every so-called laboring man, but it has escaped the notice of theorists and economists of both right and left. And now we see more and more people calling for a universal income. At least I see that on Twitter. And he really predates that by decades here. And of course, the communists would talk about overproduction as a function of capitalism. Overproduction and techniques, then, appear to have destroyed the economic imperative for imperialism. Finally, the atomic bomb and its far more terroristic descendants have infinitely diminished the use of war, as an instrument of national policy. From these points of view, imperialism as a policy of gain is as dead as the slave trade and the battleship. And if imperialism is not to be undertaken as a deliberate policy of gain, from what standpoint is it to be undertaken? Religious fervor? Popular enthusiasm for capitalism? No, the day of the Crusades is also past for the West. We shall not see the West march to conquer the world in any other fashion but that of Wall Street's and the Peace Corps. Peace Corps, unless the need to dump our products, finally can be resolved only in, quote, war, the coward's solution for the problems of peace. Now, if one were to object that the above considerations smack of the casual view of the causal view of history, against which Yaki inveighs, and assert that the final phase of our culture is subject to purely spiritual phenomena, I should be bold to suggest the possibility of a miscalculation by Spengler, which could have been based on a misinterpretation of his own data and his own theory, which, if seen in a slightly different perspective, not only clears up the meaning of the theory in the light of present developments, but also validates it completely. Space permits only the barest of outlines here, at the risk of unintelligibility to all but those initiated in the mysteries of Spenglerism. Spengler's method was to show the correlation of all aspects of the history of a cultural organism. As the Friedel quotation earlier suggests, Spengler drew analogies between apparently diverse elements within a culture, all of which are given shape and meaning by the zeitgeist, the spirit of the age, which is the creation of the cultural soul in its singular destiny. So all the different aspects that are seemingly disparate reflect instead this singular destiny of this growing, waxing and then waning, declining, dying entity that is a unique culture. Hence, in the search of the past, he saw as the culminating stage that which expresses itself spiritually as universalism. In the realm of religion, it becomes a, quote, a second religiosity, starting as a conglomeration of many sects and cults, which no one takes seriously, but everyone concerns himself with. And in parentheses, this is what we have today. It is called the social gospel and appears in a thousand forms, profane as well as sacred. It is not true religion at all, but cultism. Finally, this anarchy stabilizes into the form of a generally accepted and genuine religion. And we are about 200 years away from this. In the realm of the economic, there is big business and the growing power of money, which, however, is finally broken by the force of politics. In art, the zeitgeist expresses itself as the importation of exotic art forms and inane experimentation which has no significance whatsoever, except as a natural degeneracy of the native form. Finally, in foreign outlook, there is imperialism, military expansion. We can plainly see, says Cardo, all of the above running true to form and right on schedule except for the latter. Why? Simply because the subjection of technics to the service of the West and the mastery of economics over the West has sublimated this stage of spiritual universalism from militaristic imperialism to other forms of expansion. Verily, never before has there been such an aggressive army of gun-shy expansionists and pacifist imperialists. World government fanatics literally swarm over the West. They and others staunchly support the United Nations, an anachronism which cannot possibly be effective toward its alleged purposes, yet support for this harmful fossil is a matter of personal morality with millions. The zeitgeist is always reflected in definitions, so it is the height of insult for a white man today to be labeled an isolationist or nationalist. White folks must all be free traders, internationalist, cosmopolitan in our outlook, and this shows how far back these Jewish epithets like isolationist go. I mean, he's writing all this stuff in the 60s. Of course, I guess you could say they go even farther to World War II is where they started that garbage, or even World War I. White folks must all be free traders, internationalists, and cosmopolitan in our outlook, and how we admire the citizen of the world, whatever that is. Our view is intently focused away from our marches. It is far easier, we have discovered, to solve the problems of total strangers than to solve our own. Non-Western peoples are not so enlightened as we, and it is eagerly excused. Utilizing a newly discovered Christian double standard, which is a mark of modern moral superiority, like belonging to the Classics Book Club or contributing to the Negro College Fund. What, asks Nietzsche, has caused more suffering than the follies of the compassionate? It is good for colored peoples to be nationalistic. We encourage it, in fact, and snap up Israel bonds with a warm feeling of self-righteousness. We are joyful when colored peoples and Jews exhibit race pride, the cardinal sin and taboo of our own puritanical environment. Incidentally, why is it that every subject except one can be discussed in our enlightened age? Atheism is now a dull subject. Marxism is even duller after 100 years of popularity. A step further has taken us past plain sex to sadism and perversion. The Marquis de Sade is even becoming jaded. What racy topic is left to discuss since the equalists have brought democracy's blessings? Only one thing cannot be discussed in polite company: race. The heroes of Wall Street reap the most from this type of imperialism. And today, investors big and little interest themselves in foreign investments, which are actually given tax advantages over domestic investments. Tax favoritism, the final criterion of status in our democracy. Or they support foreign aid, remembering to stipulate, naturally, that a portion of this neat gimmick to dispose of our surplus production be allotted to their own products. The ultimate expression of this militant water pistol imperialism is the hilarious, yet deeply symbolic, Peace Corps. The Peace Corps, quote-unquote, the true expression of the zeitgeist, created out of the typically American combination of abysmal do-good stupidity and inability to gauge the feelings of others and enlightened greed, this is the perfect symbol for today. Yes, indeed. Completely expressive of the ruling WASP liberal mentality of helping the little brown folk. And this was the mentality at my college completely. Peace Corps, better than any other institution, captures the non-Jewish and mostly WASP, but, you know, German assimilated to WASP is not that much different, mentality as concerns how we should be high-minded, beautiful minds, rich in our love and knowledge of history and caring for others. We like to think that we're strafed. We're strong and we're soft. And, yeah, it's like the outward spiritual, political, secularized expression of liberalism. Helping others, doing good, doing well while doing good. Beautiful, daring minds. It just never ends with this mentality. No, we do not need imperialism so long as we have leaders like Menin Williams and Adlai Stevenson, savants like Eleanor Roosevelt and Arnold Toynbee, and altruists like Herbert Lehman, James Warburg, and Douglas Dillon to solve our problems for us. To further pursue this inquiry into the applicability of Spengler today, it is important to bring out a certain point of view which is heard most infrequently thanks to the purveyors of intellectual freedom and democracy. Neo-Spenglerians, who are attuned to the racial view of history, call them racists for convenience, hold that the final phase of a culture, the imperialistic stage, is final only because the cultural organism destroys its body and kills its soul by this process. Obviously, if we are to draw analogies between cultures and organisms, we must agree that the soul of the organism dies only because of the death of the body. The soul can sicken. The soul of the West is now diseased and perhaps mortally ill, but it cannot die unless the organism itself dies. And this, point out the racists, is precisely what has happened to all previous cultures. Death of the organism being the natural result of the suicidal process of imperialism. A word on the racial view of history before proceeding further. Today, of course, history is written from the Marxist standpoint of economics, linear progress, and class warfare. And Yaki explains this triple error well. Previous to the First World War, history was written largely from the racial point of view. History was seen as the dramatic story of the movements, struggles, and developments of races, which it is. Suppression of the racist point of view reached its apex about 1960. It is no coincidence that the power of the culture distorter in every other field, including political, gave signs, however faint, of wavering at that time, too. Perhaps the biggest reason for a growing tendency of white folks to look at the races objectively is, paradoxically, precisely because they have been forced to look at them subjectively. It is no problem to maintain a myth in ignorance. Negro equality or even supremacy, for example, is easier to believe in if there are no Negroes around to destroy the concept. In a word, internationalism in practice quickly metamorphoses into racism. To turn from experience to academic matters, how many Americans or Britons are acquainted with the stupendously elemental fact that they are, in a historical sense, Germans? That they are, like it or not, a part of the great Teutonic Celtic family which, millenniums before the dawn of Rome or even Greece, was one tribe with one language? How many otherwise enlightened and well-meaning people who have heretofore judged their patriotism according to the degree of hatred they have had for their continental brothers know that the ancestors of the great Teutonic Celtic family were the same Aryans who subjected India and civilized it, speaking the Sanskrit language and creating the caste system, which, incidentally, was nothing originally but a system of racial segregation endowed with a religious significance in order to maintain it? Or that before this there were the Sumerians and the Persians, and that the modern name for Persia, Iran, is merely a corruption of Aryan? Greece and Rome also were created by this great, far-roving, culture-bearing race of conquerors. In whatever part of the world it went, a different civilization was created, each of which was distinctive because it developed in tune with the environmental conditions in whatever location its history began, yet bearing the unmistakable traces of its Aryan origin. There are some civilizations about which we know little, as far as the racial elements are concerned. All we know for certain about the Egyptians is that they were Caucasian, and that they, like all slave masters, mingled their blood with that of their Negro slaves. As for the so-called Amerindian civilizations, we now know without a doubt that civilization was superimposed upon Indian savages by a white racial stock. In his popular books Kon-Tiki and Aku Aku, Thor Heyerdahl cleverly reveals the forbidden racist view, in spite of the fact that a million people who are familiar with the adventure described in the books are totally ignorant of the deep racial message he wrote into them. It is a sad commentary indeed when a gifted scientist, in order to reveal a simple truth, must risk his life and then write an adventure story in code which, when interpreted, shows a forbidden fact. In Kon-Tiki, which is a big book in the 70s, so I guess this was written after I thought it was. At least I think it was written in the 70s, but that's when it was popular and they were making TV shows and such. In Kon-Tiki, Thor Heyerdahl writes, "There is not a trace of gradual development in the high civilizations which once stretched from Mexico to Peru. The deeper the archaeologists dig, the higher the culture, until a definite point is reached at which the old civilizations have clearly arisen without any foundation in the midst of primitive cultures." End quote. All of the wonders in South and Central America before the arrival of the Spaniards had been brought about suddenly by a race of white conquerors, and that, as they melted their blood slowly into that of their subject native population, the civilization dwindled. The very reason Cortes conquered the Aztecs so easily was because Montezuma believed that the Spaniards were the fair-skinned, bearded men coming from the east, which Quetzalcoatl's prophecy foretold would return. And the Incas in Peru had the very same legend. The name Inca, by the way, is the name only of the aristocracy of the Peruvians. The Incas were white, and the princesses were quite beautiful, so much so that many of the Spanish officers married them and took them back to Spain. A glance at the present Incas in Peru shows that at once that these were not the creators of the great Peruvian culture. Some of the very best writing on this subject, and for that matter on the fascinating subject of world prehistory, is found in Paul Herman's Conquest by Man, an extremely valuable book, which, strangely enough, is now in print. Harper Publishers. Paul Herman's Conquest by Man. An even cloudier origin must be ascribed to the Chinese civilization. Suffice it to say that there is abundant indication of early white movements in North China. The Tocharians, remember all the white blonde mummies. And there is much similarity between early Chinese culture and Babylonian. Genghis Khan, a Mongol, came from a tribe called the Gray-Eyed Men, according to biographer Harold Lamb, and he had red hair and green eyes. The Chinese have shown that they have the ability to maintain a civilization, but we cannot prove that they have ever created one. The intensive suppression, misrepresentation, condemnation, and opposition to the racial view of history has had its effect. We still not only have much to learn, the surface of prehistory has barely been scratched and will never be more than scratched if the scientists persist in spending their time in well-financed projects in the so-called cradle of civilization in the Middle East, but the results of historical perversion have been satisfyingly abundant in the social area. This has allowed the distorter to convince Europe that all Europe has it owes to the Greeks, the Romans, and an obscure tribe of vagabonds, which some religious crackpots refer to as God's chosen people. That's an asterisk. Or, as Samuel Hoffenstein put it in his earthquaking couplet, how odd of God to choose the Jews. In the testimony of the Spade, however, Jeffrey Bibby relates some results of straying off of the beaten archaeological tract and looking for the origins of Europe in Europe instead of the alien Orient. Results which will be surprising to persons brought up to believe that their ancestors were bearskin-clad savages, civilized only when forced to acknowledge the superiority of Rome. In truth, virtually everything the West has it owes to itself, including holidays like Christmas and Easter, originally Teutonic celebrations of the winter solstice and the coming of spring, with the latter celebration dedicated to the goddess Estra, to law, ethics, and single-breasted jackets. The world wears leather shoes and trousers, not sandals and togas. Wearing apparel very similar to items sold at Sears Roebuck today have been discovered in Europe dating back some 3,000 years. The Western culture had its birth many millenniums ago. It began autochthonously and developed to the present point when it now stands upon the verge of physical and spiritual annihilation, only because it has ceased to believe in itself. That's in italics. This is the lesson we glean. So it began autochthonously. A word I've only other seen used by Camille Paglia means, and like kind of similar to endemically, it sprung up from these people in this location. It didn't come in from somewhere else. Further, says Cardo, there is a correlation too perfect to be a coincidence, in that in every case on record of the death or stagnation of a culture, there has been simultaneously an abortive attempt to digest large numbers of cultural and racial aliens into the organism. In the case of Rome and Greece, death came about through imperialism and the resulting inevitable backwash of conquered people and races into the heartland as slaves, bringing exotic religions, different philosophies, in a word, cultural sophistication first, then cultural anarchy. In the case of Persia, India, and the Amerindian civilizations, a race of conquerors superimposed their civilization upon a mass of indigenous people. The area flourished for a while, then the culture vanished, or in the case of America, was on the verge of vanishing, as the descendants of the conquerors became soft, fat, and liberal, and took on more and more of the accoutrements and blood of the subject population. In the case of Egypt, the alien blood was brought in over the course of many centuries by the importation of Negro slaves. The inevitable racial mongrelization followed, creating the Egypt we know today. We thus see the real reason underlying the inevitable decline and destruction of a cultural organism. It is because, at a certain stage, a culture develops a bad case of universalism. Speaking pathologically, unless this is sublimated to harmless channels by proper treatment, It will inevitably kill the organism through the absorption of a resulting flood of alien microbes. It is therefore the natural byproduct of universalism which kills the organism. The death of the organism itself is neither natural nor necessary. This conclusion comes by a synthesis of the Spenglerian and the racial point of view. Each tempers the other. Together, a comprehensive and hopeful theory of history can be developed, which holds a deep meaning to Westerners of this day. At all costs, the imperialistic phase of our development must be avoided, and we must guard against the digestion of alien matter we have already partially absorbed. And again, he's writing this, well, again, I'm not sure. Is he writing this before? Yeah, it doesn't matter. Before or after the 1965 Immigration Act that opened up the borders, and then we saw the same thing in Australia, the ending of the white policy there. And the same thing in Britain, taking in all the people from around the empire, particularly if they were colored. The more we absorb these foreign peoples, we start to race mix and blood poison our culture and thereby kill it. So, quit with that racial knowledge, he's saying. We can perhaps avoid the last or terminal stage of cultural organic evolution, the imperialist, and thereby prolong the life of the culture that we prefer and that we create. The West need not die if it learns to sublimate the present universal stage of the West from the orthodox to something more constructive, which will not only satisfy the inevitable yearning that the West now displays for expansion and universalism, but at the same time will provide a basis for the West to continue its development. What can that be? Faintly shining above the wreckage of seven cultures, we can now detect a dim ray of hope which gives to us, as men of the West, reason to believe that the destiny of our culture can work itself out through a completely new path. This ray of hope shines from the same developments which have brought the West to its position of unqualified superiority to every other culture. For the West has already embarked upon the greatest adventure in all history, the attempt to conquer space, the attempt to bring the very universe under the control of the race. This imperative needs no justification other than the one Sir Edmund Hillary gave when he was asked why he wanted to climb Mount Everest. Because it's there. This is the pristine reality of the Faustian soul of the West, and it is beyond the logic of the rationalists. Could any goal be at once so totally challenging, so impudent and impossible as this, and also so metaphysically necessary to the spiritual need of our culture? And more, could any goal be so perfectly adapted to the physical situation in which we find ourselves? The fates have provided the West well with the means of survival. At this point in history, our technics, industrial overproduction, and the population explosion become all important, for we see that finally the West has the means to turn the poetic imperative of the Faustian drive for the infinite to reality, indeed the inescapable need to do so. For it is true that, regardless of all arguments to the contrary, Western man is bound to conquer space or to die in the attempt. No longer is the drive toward infinity and largeness held back by earthly boundaries. Now, in fact, we have infinity at our elbow. What I am suggesting is that at last the white man has burst the ties to earth. I am stating the simple fact that, barring calamity caused by universal physical or biological destruction, we are now headed for the stars, and there is no power in heaven or earth to stop us. And I think about, I'm not personally interested in space exploration, and I absolutely loathe it as an object of government wasted money, which it is. Before you think that's merely my opinion, I used to write about this stuff, and I know what I'm talking about. NASA is a tremendous boondoggle. But now, I have nothing against private space exploration. SpaceX is creating a big, huge space down by South Padre at the extreme southern tip of Texas, and they have already shown that they could blast off rockets and then return them and kind of land them as if you were watching the film of the blast off in reverse. That's what they're working on. Of course, they've had a failure, but that's what exploration is. There's lots of failure before you succeed. But anyway, they are doing good things with private money, SpaceX. And so he says, coming days will see the present drive for space magnified 1,000-fold, 1,000,000-fold. All limits to the possibility of expansion have disappeared. Geographical expansion on Earth is senseless, and worse than senseless, it is suicide. The frontier has come back, a frontier that can never be dissipated. And with that frontier comes literally limitless opportunities, not only for physical expansion, but for economic exploitation, and for the soul of Faustian man to find its true expression. Of course, man cannot conquer the heavens, man cannot move the solar system, change planets in their orbits, add billions of square miles of dirt to the surface of the Earth, move other planets closer to the life-giving sun to adapt them for colonization, refuel the sun when it starts to fade, and, most noble impossibility of all, actually upgrade the human species through deliberate biological mechanics, for in the attempt to conquer nature we must fail, and this is the eternal tragedy of the Faustian soul, says Spengler in Man and Technics. But, and this is the important thing, we can try. And we will. The final end does not matter. Time has no end. Only the goal matters. And he had an asterisk after upgrade the human species biologically. It says, in Nature and Man's Fate, biologist Garrett Hardin of the University of California has done what too few academicians can do, created a book of both beauty and far-seeing scope. But alas, words are only words. Politics alone, let us ever remember, is the art of the possible. But now, from the vantage point of 2016, it sure as heck does look like we can at least do some good and negative eugenics and weed out diseases through knowing the genome. At the same time, there is the grave danger that we will, with our attention fixed on the nearing stars, succumb to the subtle urging of the culture distorter and with the C and D capitalized, and ignore the problems at home. The infinite challenge is of an unspeakable excitement, but the mundane problem of the quality of men and their earthy existence, their earthy environment, is of more importance. Our venture to the infinity, our venture to infinity, will be very short-lived if we come home to an earth peopled with a rapidly degenerating human species. To nights that crawl with the prowlings of depraved, raceless savages, with only barred doors keeping the jungle out of the laboratory and the boudoir until day breaks. To a tyranny over our government that is exercised by organized and predatory minorities. To impossible taxes to support degenerative welfare schemes that are deliberately designed to proliferate the unfit and inferior at the expense of the productive and creative. To an organized filth that calls itself literature. To the ethical syphilis of Hollywood. To systematic lies that masquerade as scholarship, to purposeful journalistic and official propaganda that has as its sole aim the perpetuation of cultural decline, to thraldom to an economic system dedicated to extirpating individual excellence and personal responsibility, to a liberal philosophy and sick religion, perfect for slaves, which ferociously combats all creative efforts of noble souls, revealing its own loftiest aspiration to be the implantation of a subconscious death wish in our people, to a cowardly hypocrisy that makes it impossible to speak of our real problems. And all of this for the purpose of stabilizing the total supremacy of the culture distorter, which feeds and fattens on these conditions. Oswald Spengler, then, can be seen not as the prophet of inevitable doom, but as a challenger, as a seer who was, in common with all great creators, unable to see the final consequences of his creation. Hence the importance of Spengler becomes the size of the future, and all men who are free from the grip of the destroyers must, as a categorical imperative, accept his basic teaching. What we do with it, whether or not we have the courage to build upon the structure he built, this is up to us. We must hope that more men like Yaki will come to add a little more onto the concept he created, for the development of the Western cultural organism is not coming to an end. It is just beginning. What is the significance of the Imperium? Simply this, that now, for the first time, those soldiers who enlist in the service of the West have a profound theory to inspire and guide them. Imperium, after conquering all attempts to suppress it and destroy it, as have all constructive advances in the past of man, is seen as the only foundation which can be used to overthrow the inner enemies, reconquer the soul of the West, and pave the way to the future. In spite of the difference of opinion which Imperium will stir, this much is certain. Here is a book which is basically different from other books, precisely as the author states on the first page. Whether it does indeed signal a turning point in history, such as the author describes, or not, it contains a vast amount of pregnant thinking and new concepts which any fair-minded person will welcome. It breaks through the straitjacket of present sterile intellectualism, which affronts us from 1,000 feudal towers of higher learning, and will undoubtedly endow every reader with possessions of thought which will enrich him and, in time, our culture. Whether the apocalyptic prophecies are borne out, or whether an alternative and more constructive course can be imposed upon history, or whether the West and the world will come to its finality not with a bang but with a whimper, only the unfoldment of time can tell, but no intelligent man will ignore Imperium. In one respect, Imperium is akin to Das Kapital, for Karl Marx gave to the conspiratorial culture distorter the necessary ideological mask to hide its mission of ruthless, total destruction. He provided an ugly and invalid theory of man, cloaked in putrefying equality, mewling hypocrisy, the disease of undiscriminating altruism, and the science of economics. By so doing, he thrilled the rationalists with a totally specious verity, something their stunted, guilty souls desperately needed after they killed God. Francis Parker Yockey has done the same thing for those who are constructive-minded and who have the intellectual and moral courage to face reality and seek and speak truth. This is why, although Yockey's plan for the West may not be perfect, it contains atomic power. If only one man reading this book is influenced to lead, and if others are made to see the world a little more clearly than they do now, and if they are thereby enabled to discriminate between their true friends and their real enemies, and to recognize the need for leadership and coordinated action, then Yockey's life of suffering and persecution and his monumental accomplishment, in spite of all, has not been in vain. And whatever course destiny may take from this day forth, I shall always be baffled by two questions. For one, is the republication of this book, in itself, concrete evidence that his prophecy is being worked out? And lastly, now you must accept this at my word and question me no further, it is most strange that two men, neither of whom can bring themselves to believe in either destiny nor eternal justice, that these two heathens and bitter realists, these two rationalists, if you will, were the only ones with faith enough to take it upon themselves to see that Imperium is not forgotten, but is made available for you, dear reader. W. A. Cardo, that's the end of his introduction. And notice that's what you always find when you find racialists. There are some Christians among them, but generally they are not Christian, and they are the ones with faith. They are the ones who want this future for our race. The religious man doesn't care because all that matters is God and his relation to it as an individual. And he defines his community as a community of believers, and that's not a skin color. Belief is not a race. And now we'll move on, and this is much briefer, to Yockey's foreword to his work. And Yockey says, and that was about 40 pages or so for the introduction by Cardo. Now Yockey says in his foreword, this book is different from other books. First of all, it is only in form a book at all. It is only in form that it's a book at all. In reality, it is a part of the life of action. It is a turning point in European history. A late turning point, but a real one. There is nothing original in the content of this book. The book itself only is the original. The craze for originality is a manifestation of decadence, and the decadence of Europe is the ascendancy of the barbarian. This is the first of a line of works, the political literature of Europe. Heretofore, all political works on the imperative side have been addressed to one nation of Europe alone. Among other things, this book marks the end of rationalism. It does not bring it about. Not books, but only the advance of history can accomplish anything of that sort. It merely rings its funeral knell. Thus, the imperative side of life returns to its pristine source, the will to power. Henceforth, there will be no discussion of action in terms of abstract thought. And then a couple more pages for this. Henceforth, there will be no discussion of action in terms of abstract thought. Now he says, this is addressed to all Europe, and in particular to the culture-bearing stratum of Europe. It summons Europe to a world historical struggle of 2 centuries duration. Europe will partake in this struggle either as a participant or as the booty for marauding powers from without. If it is to act, and not merely to suffer in this series of gigantic wars, it must be integrated, and there is only one way, italics, this can occur. The Western culture is suffering from disease, and the prolongation of this disease is the prolonging of Chinese conditions in Europe. The word Europe changes its meaning. From now on, it means the Western civilization. The organic unity which created as phases of its life the nation ideas of Spain, Italy, France, England, and Germany. These former nations are all dead. The era of political nationalism has passed. This has not happened through logical necessity, but through the organic advance of the history of the West. It is this organic necessity which is the source of our imperative and of the integration of Europe. The significance of the organic is that its alternatives are either to do the necessary or to sicken and die. The present chaos, 1948, is directly traceable to the attempt to prevent the integration of Europe. As a result, Europe is in a swamp, and extra-European forces dispose of former European nations as their colonies. In this book are the precise organic foundations of the Western soul, and in particular, its imperative at this present stage. Either Europe will become totally integrated, or it will pass entirely out of history. Its peoples will be dispersed. Its efforts and brains will be at the disposal forever of extra-European forces. This is shown herein, not by abstract formulae and intellectualized theories, but organically and historically. The conclusions, therefore, are not arbitrary, not a subject for choosing or rejecting, but absolutely compelling to minds which wish to take part in affairs. The real author is the spirit of the age, and its commands do not admit of argumentation, and their sanction is the crushing might of history, bringing defeat, humiliation, death, and chaos. I condemn here at the outset the miserable plans of retarded souls to unite Europe as an area of economic area for purposes of exploitation by and defense of the imperialism of extra-European forces. Jean Monnet, the father of European integration. Coal and steel community and such. I remember learning about that as an international relations major in the 80s. The integration of Europe is not a subject for plans, but for expression. It needs but to be recognized, and the perpetuation of 19th century economic thinking is entirely incapable here. Not trade and banking, not importing and exporting, but heroism alone can liberate that integrated soul of Europe which lies under the financial trickery of its retarders, the petty statism of party politicians, and the occupying armies of extra-European forces. The imperative integration of Europe takes the form of unity of people, race, nation, state, society, will, and naturally also economy. The spiritual unity of Europe is there. Its liberation will automatically allow the full blooming of the other phases of the organic unity, which all flow from the spiritual. And thus, this book is a renewal of a war declaration. It asks the traitors to Europe, the miserable party politicians whose tenure of office is dependent upon their continued serviceability to extra-European forces, did you think it was over? Do you think that your misery and shame will remain securely forever on a world stage which has seen true heroes upon it? In the war which you let loose, you taught men how to die, and thereby you have freed a spirit which will engulf you next. Which will engulf you next, the spirit of heroism and discipline. There is no currency that can buy this spirit, but it can overcome any currency. It's stronger than any money power. Lastly, this book is itself the first blow in the gigantic war for the liberation of Europe. The prime enemy is the traitor within Europe, who alone makes possible the starving and looting of Europe by the outer forces. He is the symbol of chaos and death. Between him and the spirit of the 20th century is unremitting war. It reminds you of Angela Merkel, tool of George Soros and the Jew billionaire bankers, bringing millions of raping, looting, hating Muslims into the heart of Germany, the heart of Europe. Disgusting. That's who he's talking about. Petty politicians, career girls serving their own interest by wrecking their own nations at the command of the Jew, or the culture distorter, as we're going to find that Yaki calls him. Anyway, that's his foreword. It's brief. Ulrich Varang, his pen name. British Bay, we know that's in Ireland, January 30th, 1948. Anyway, that's the introduction to Imperium, and we're going to go through it in subsequent days. And I want to thank you for being with me, and I'll be back with you again real soon.